research and other research outside the inside and outside the agency. Prior to arriving at NASA, Terry was on the faculty at Oregon State University, and still is, where she was teaching botany, and I think introduced one of the first astrobiology training courses in the country. In her current position, Terry is one of the highest-ranking life scientists in the agency, and has been a tireless advocate of life sciences and the study of living things in space. Last November, as I mentioned, Terry conducted a workshop at headquarters where she charged us to conduct a workshop here on the biological effects of lunar dust. There had been multiple workshops on dust across the country. There was one at Marshall Space Center on simulants, and we'll be talking about simulants. Simulants are a key issue in the study of this in biological systems. And there have also been in situ resource utilization dust workshops. There's going to be another dust workshop in May in Colorado on EVA systems. So this is an area that's come back up into the radar screen very rapidly, and I think it's really powered by the exploration system spirals that will take us to the moon and to Mars. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Terry Lomax.
Exactly what the dangers were of the dust, what were the issues that we needed to be worried about, and how that was going to impact the research we did from here on out. Go to that, to the next slide. This was the source of the turbulence that Russ was talking about. So what happened on January 14th last year, so it is a year and 2 months ago now, was President Bush coming to NASA headquarters to announce the vision for space exploration. And I mentioned getting past low Earth orbit. And I didn't realize it. I just came to NASA a little over 2 years ago from Oregon State. But I've been a NASA PI for almost 20 years. But what I didn't realize is that NASA had really been in the penalty box, that we weren't allowed to go beyond the ISS because of the cost overruns and other problems that have been with managing that. It was, do not pass ISS, do not, you know, go directly to jail, basically, if you did. And so what this was NASA getting out of the penalty box and being allowed to go beyond low Earth orbit for human space exploration, and it was a very exciting moment. And it was exciting to be there and watch this enormous shift that NASA is turn very rapidly in this new direction. But whenever you turn a large ship that fast, you get that turbulence and you get that wake, and some of that's what's going on. But it's also a lot of excitement at the same time, being able now to move forward and actually be planning on our missions to Moon and mission to Mars. So what was called for, this is actually a national security policy directive that came out of the White House, was this vision to advance the U.S. scientific, and notice they say scientific first, security and economic interest through a robust space exploration program. And there's some key parts of it. One of it is to be sustainable and affordable. So again, this isn't like the first President Bush's space exploration program with a huge price ticket, and it's not Apollo. What this is a journey, not a race. And so it's to be sustainable and affordable. And then the next thing is key also, human and robotic. So it put to bed this argument about should we do human exploration or should we do robotic exploration. The answer is yes. The best thing is a combination of the both where you use the right one to get the most advantage for a certain thing that you want to find out in exploration. And to do the entire solar system and beyond. So it really, all of a sudden, we're out of low Earth orbit and solar system is beyond. It's this huge new scope and this huge new vision. And the idea is to extend the human presence across the solar system. And I put this part in red Because here's the key thing for this work, starting with a human return to the moon by the year 2020, in preparation for human exploration of Mars and other destinations. So to prepare to go to Mars, what that means is also going beyond Apollo. We're not spending 3 or 4 days there. What we need to do is we need to go for, say, 90 days to be able to test out the kinds of life support and mobility and all of those things that we're going to need to be able to do Mars. And we're not going to go to Mars for just 3 or 4 days. And so we need to be able to have a whole new range of technologies to be able to support this. And then another key thing is to develop the innovative technologies, knowledge, and infrastructures to explore and support the decisions about human space exploration. And of course, we want to do this still with international participation, and there's a renewed emphasis on commercial participation in exploration. So it's really a new way of doing business. So I know this is difficult to read in the back, but I put the key things in the red. There was 18 key points in the vision. And so part of it was, the first one is return the shuttle to safe flight. So we're not abandoning ISS. We need ISS as a test bed to be able to know more about how to function in reduced gravity. So we need to return the shuttle to safe flight as soon as possible. That date's now set for May 15th. So keep your fingers crossed that everything comes together. They've rolled they're rolling the shuttle out. I mean, they've assembled it. They're rolling it out. Really looking like we're heading for a May 15th launch. There's a window there. There's another window in July. But after that, there's not a good window for quite a while. So we're hoping to make one of those two windows. And the reason why the windows are so narrow now is part of its alignment, but part of it is they're only going to launch in the light for the time being, not in the dark. As much safety as possible. The second goal is to use the shuttle to complete ISS assembly, because as I said, ISS is required for exploration, but then to retire the shuttle as soon as possible after we get all the things that need the real heavy lift up there, so hopefully around 2010. Next is to focus ISS research to support exploration goals. So in the past, we didn't have that goal beyond station. And so it made it difficult to focus what was the research that was most important to do there. Well, now we have the ability to really focus it, to know what phasing needs to take place. And so we know we have certain things to do to be ready to go to the moon and to go to Mars. And so focus on those areas. Meet our foreign commitments. We have a lot with our international partners on the International Space Station. And then, again, I'm putting in red the ones I think are really key for this workshop. Undertake lunar exploration to support sustained human and robotic exploration of Mars and beyond. And what that means is a series of robotic missions to the moon. And here's where he started giving us some real action items and dates, because for the first robotic one, he said by 2008 to prepare for human exploration. Oh, everyone was really excited to get to start doing moon missions again. But then we realized if you count back, it takes a certain amount of time to get a mission ready. And we were 6 months behind the ball to start one already when he made this announcement for 2008. So it's going to be late 2008, put it that way. But, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what we've selected for that first mission later on in my talk. Then the expeditions to the lunar surface, and that means human expeditions, as early as, here he gave us a little more room, he didn't give us 1 year, as early as 2015, but no later than 2020. So that gave us a box now that we need to plan for getting humans back to the moon. And then to use lunar activities to further science, so what Scott was just talking about in his talk, the different kinds of science that we need to do, not only lunar geophysics and things learning like that, but also life sciences and what happens to life as we get beyond our planet. And to test approaches, including understanding lunar resources, for exploration to Mars and beyond. So the way I like to put it is that it's just unconscionable to set off for Mars without testing out the camping gear first. And so we need to have all of our camping gear well tested out on the moon and understand how it works in fractional G to be able to do that. And so that would be that. But also, what kind of resources are there? Is there a chance we could make propellant on the moon? Are the right things there that we could do that so that we wouldn't have to carry it all out of first orbit with us. And then it goes on from there to the robotic exploration of Mars to prepare for future explorations. So that's adding on. We already have a very successful Mars program with a lot of its goals in astrobiology. But now we need to add, what else do we have to have on robotic missions? And do we need additional robotic missions to prepare for the human presence there? To continue to conduct robotic exploration across the solar system, to conduct advanced telescope searches, so NASA's still going forward with its telescopes. Hubble's reaching the end of its lifetime, but there's four new telescopes coming online. That's the part you don't usually hear about when everybody's, oh no, we're losing Hubble, but there's four new ones coming. To demonstrate, and here we're getting into those technologies that are so key, power, propulsion, and life support capabilities. So life support is right there in the vision. For long duration, more distant human and robotic missions. To conduct human exploration expeditions to Mars after we know enough and we have our capability demonstrations done. And another key thing is to develop a new crew exploration vehicle. So we don't have the right vehicle right now to be going on to Mars and beyond. So we need to move past shuttle to a new crew exploration vehicle. And again, here, they want a flight test before the end of the decade. I'll tell you more about that. And the ability to send humans to the moon by 2014 or so. And then we need to separate cargo from crew as soon as possible. This idea of having the same ship that you use to carry the crew, carry the cargo like the shuttle does, may not be the safest way to go. And so we need to separate those out. And then continue our international participation and pursue commercial opportunities. So one way we're doing this, and this is being led by the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate, and Admiral Steibel, our associate administrator, was brought in to develop some of this new style of doing business, is as a way to implement the vision for space exploration. One of the key things, and I'll tell you more about this, is spiral development. So we don't know what all the requirements are now for going to Mars. We don't know exactly what kind of vehicle we need to build, what kind of life support capability we need to have. But we need to get started. So we go through spirals, and I'll show you, for low Earth orbit, for the moon. And instead of locking in the requirements now, we keep adjusting them and adjusting what the vehicle is going to be like so that we can infuse new technologies as we go on. And also looking at it really as a system of systems, as all of the components that are necessary, and I'll talk more about that. One of the things we're doing is a strategy to task to technology process, and so that's very requirements-driven, as both Scott and Russ were saying. And so you do things because there's a need for it, not because, gee, this seems like a good idea. And so it's developing those requirements that's so important. That's the key to everything else, and so that's part of what this workshop is going for, is what kind of requirements we have with respect to lunar dust. And that we have operational advisory groups, so that we actually have the people that have been on the moon, or who are now current crew members, the ones who are actually, or the scientists that are going to go out and do the work, or people who represent them, because we don't know who that's going to be yet, but that we actually have operational advisory groups, that it's not just people that design stuff without that input. Also, we're using innovative acquisition strategies, and so we've gone to broad agency announcements. This gives us a lot more flexibility, and so we can go faster than the old NASA research announcements that you might know. The NASA research announcement is actually a subset of a broad agency announcement, directly going to the broader set of rules rather than the more strict ones than there was for NRAs. We're really promoting competition, competing everything we do, and promoting collaboration. So trying to set up these broad agency announcements so they encourage the NASA Center working with universities and with industry and everyone working together. And with government and industry partnerships. A really new way I think is very effective is first putting out a request for information. So before you do a broad agency announcement or other kind of solicitation, find out what all's out there. Not just looking, people looking from their own knot hole, and then use those to generate requests for proposals and other kinds. And then we've been holding conferences to try to include our international participation. It's still not clear how that's going to be at this point, but we're trying to keep connected with that community. And then with our acquisition strategy and execution, we're really looking at what are the best ways of managing both what NASA has used before, what DOD uses, and what industry and academia use to try to generate new ways of doing things. Using an integrated agency approach, stovepipes, and using disciplined and institutional processes. And that's where a lot of the turbulence and change is coming from, is working with these new processes that we're not accustomed to anymore. And then, of course, this is going to take a huge amount of systems engineering and integration to pull this big new endeavor together. And we're not forgetting about inspiring, because that's one of the main things that NASA does. So education, exciting, and recruiting as we move on. Because this is really something now that students and kids and the public and everyone can get very excited about this new thing. Oh, I think I just missed one. Wow. And so a key thing for this group to understand is what this results in is a building block approach. So return to flight, hopefully we're just about there. Complete ISS and complete our work that we need to do there. Move from there to humans on the moon to prepare for humans to Mars. And so the whole key for the moon thing is we wouldn't be going back to the moon in the sense we're doing it now if we weren't going to Mars. So you need to keep the context of, you know, why are the things that we're doing on the moon important for Mars? That's really the reason for going there. There's a lot of fascinating things about the moon, and we can work on those while we're there. It's not that we're shutting that out, but we're using them as a context to get ready to go on to Mars. So here's the spirals I was telling you about, and I'm going to take a moment to really let you understand this, because this is really important. And so spiral number one is a low Earth orbit. And so what that is developing this crew exploration vehicle to get as a transportation low Earth orbit. We've got ISS there, but we need something to replace shuttle that will enable us to go on beyond and keep building on it. And so the first step is just to get that back to low Earth orbit. And that's going to be in the time of 2008 will be the first unmanned demonstration of the crew exploration vehicle. And by 2014, we want it to be manned and ready to go to the moon. So then spiral two is then from 2015 to 2020. That's that time I told you the vision said that we need to be sending humans back to the moon. And so the first part of that is going to be to get 4 to 6 crew, so bigger crews than we had in Apollo, to a lunar stay surface for what they call extended duration. And that extended duration is probably the length of a lunar day, about 14 days is the idea about what that would be. So now we have to jump beyond that 3 to 4 days when that suit was ready to freeze up after 3 days and be ready to function due to the dust and be ready to function for 14 days. So it's all the technologies and all the capabilities to be able to send humans there that long. And then spiral three is the long duration human exploration. I'm not sure who came up with these terms. I'm not sure about, I would have chosen extended versus long. I get that. But the concept for the long duration human exploration is to spend 30 to 90 days on the moon. So now we're really testing the camping gear. Now we're really trying to show that we're self-sufficient, not do resupply from Earth, and be able to mimic what we're going to be doing on Mars as much as absolutely possible. And so that's going to start around 2020 and go until TBD, until we can show that we have the capabilities that we can do that in a sustained and affordable manner. So, do the math. And then finally, spiral four is it's not quite so clearly defined, but that one's mostly for the vehicle. That's the human exploration to Mars vicinity. That's really a capability to have a vehicle that can get us to Mars. I don't know how many people are going to want to go on a mission where you go 6 months, look at Mars, and come back. There's people like who would, but hard for me to imagine. But then the key one, and the one that all this goes towards, spiral five, is the human exploration of the Mars surface. So that's actually getting humans down to the Mars surface and be able to have the capabilities there to be able to do exploration. And so everything before that is to develop up to that point. but adding those capabilities, infusing those technologies as you go on out. And this just adds a little bit more to that and puts it in a written way. So Spiral 1, as I said, is the human new transportation system, and not just for the humans, but also for cargo to low Earth orbit no later than 2015. But the other thing that didn't show in that other slide is this is where the lunar robotic exploration is taking place to get ready for the humans to go back. So that first lunar mission, robotic mission I told you about is going to be an orbiter. It's going to go in 08. I'm going to tell you more about what's going to be on it. But we're probably going to have three more missions after that of lunar robotic missions, landed or orbiters. We're still trying to decide right now what's the best package of what we're going to need to do. This workshop will help decide some of that package. What are the key things we need to do on those first lunar robotic missions to prepare for the humans? Spiral 2, as I said, that's the extended human duration. Between 2015 and 2020 at some time, but it's also where the Mars robotic exploration is going to be key. Not just that to do the science, but that to prepare for the human presence. Spiral 3 will be continuing with the Mars robotic exploration as we do the longer times on the moon. And then I said Spiral 4 is human exploration to the vicinity, and Spiral 5, the Mars surface exploration. So a real key part of this, as I mentioned early on, is to consider this as a system of systems. And so these systems are to be integrated. And one thing that we're keeping central this time is the human as an essential element of the system of systems, as sort of the central element, because this is human space exploration. So we're starting right from the beginning to design the human into all the systems. What are the requirements? What are the needs? That's where the operational advisory group comes in. It's where groups like this that can advise us on biological effects come in. Is how do we design from there on out? What is that? What are the impacts for that for the transit and launch systems, or for the surface and the orbital systems, or for the evolvability of human future missions, the technology options that we choose, especially for life support, and then the kinds of supporting research that we need to be able to tell us what we need to put the human factors into this. And this is just to show you in a little more detail how things are proceeding right now. And so what we're doing is we're devolving down from the vision itself, because that's what's driving us right now, to those requirements that we keep mentioning. So what do we need to accomplish the vision? And then what that goes down is into the development of the research and the development of technologies. And so here are the different components of the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate. So we have an Exploration Systems Research and Technology Program. And what that is, the way I think of it is, it's everything from the vessel out. And so it's building the vessel itself, the technologies you need for that, power and propulsion, and the things you need externally to that. We have human systems research and technology, and that's everything from the vessel in. It's the humans and the things that they come into contact, and the things they need also outside for extravehicular activities, so the closely associated stuff. So that's where the life sciences research is, that's where the life support and habitation research is, and that's where the space human factors, space human systems integration, those interfaces between the humans and the robotics are, is in human systems research and technology. We have our small business program that we're focusing in this area, and then PNST is the Prometheus Nuclear Systems and Technology. And so that's really going to determine a lot of the architecture of what we can do far out, is what kind of propulsion systems and power systems that we have. And so Prometheus is where we're developing those new nuclear technologies. And they probably will be involved in one of the lunar demonstrations early on, the robotic ones. So we have from research to low TRL to high TRL to tech maturation. Sorry, that's NASA talk. TRL is technology readiness level. And so you have things that are an idea, that's basically technology readiness level 0. All the way up to things that will actually be implemented and put into the vehicle's technology readiness level 9 and use. And So we did requests for information early on. We did concept refinements, and we did a broad agency announcement, mostly in the exploration systems research and technology area, because we were still converting our old life sciences programs. And then what they did there was they chose 11 contractors, and some of these are groups, and they're university, they're large things like Boeing and Lockheed, they're small things like T-Space and MIT, other groups that are really helping us with our concept evaluation and our refinement of those. And so they're looking both at the vehicle itself and what the lunar mission should be. So they're helping us with the lunar planning. So there's 11 of those. Request for proposals just came out for the crew exploration vehicle. And the idea is going to be, is I'm going to select two contractors this summer, two regular contractors. And what's happening right now is a lot of these groups are forming into mega groups to be the ones to bid on the crew exploration vehicle. But they also want to keep some non-traditional type approaches, the things you saw on the SpaceX Prize and stuff like that going, because we have Burt Rutan and people like that in the groups also. So we want to keep those out-of-the-box things going on at the same time as we're going with more traditional contractor kinds of things. And so what they'll be doing then is there'll be these three funded, and between the two big ones, there'll be a down select in 2008 with that first demo. Remember I said the first, it won't be an entire crew exploration vehicle, but it'll be figuring out the key technologies and demonstrating them. And then we'll have a down select. So let's just keep as much competition in it for as long as possible before building the actual vehicle. And then we'll have that first uncrewed flight around 2011 and the first crewed flight in 2014. And constantly what we're trying to do is motivate the technologies that are being developed in our other programs to be incorporated in. So that's being built in, that they're required to keep incorporating those technologies. And then finally, to the moon by 2015 to 2020, and then on to Mars. So why the moon? We've been called up to Congress several times to answer that question. There's a lot of people that would like to go straight to Mars. Why go back to the moon first? Well, these are some of our answers. Because what it really is a test bed to reduce risk for the future human Mars missions. So it allows us to do the technology advancement to reduce mission costs and support expanded human exploration. It allows us to test our systems, make sure everything works together in the fractional environment and the harsh environment. Think of the amounts of the really, really cold is one of the things you're going to have to deal with. To expand our mission and surface operations experience, doing science. We haven't been back on the moon for a long time. We need to get our operations geared back up. It's very different than going to the ISS, operating on the surface, and I'm sure Pearson will tell us about that. To work further on enhancing our human and machine collaboration, to break the bonds of dependence on Earth, so really so that we can have life support, closed loop life support tests to make sure that we can do that. So we can do the power generation and propulsion development and testing, especially the nuclear things. I think they're going to be a lot happier if we do there. And there's a lot of common investments on things that you would do for the moon and Mars and other space objectives. So it's not like we're spending a lot on a whole program that doesn't go someplace else. So I promised to tell you quickly about the Lunar Robotic Orbiter that we're doing in 08, known as LRO. And the main goal of this is to prepare for human exploration. But what you'll see is it also does a lot to benefit our knowledge of lunar science. One thing I hadn't realized is that everything we've done in the past is really around the equator of the moon. And that's not the whole moon. There's more than one moon. And especially at the polar regions seem to be very interesting, and there's a possibility of ice there. We need to find out if it really is ice or what is the hydrogen signature that we're seeing there. It's also permanently shadowed areas or permanently lit areas that are quite different than what you find around the equator. And so the main objectives of the orbiter was to look at biological adaptation to the lunar environment, and we're just taking a baby step there so far, to understand the current state and evolution of the volatiles, the ice, or other resources, and to develop an understanding of the moon in support of the human exploration. So we need to know more about the hazards, about the topography, so we can do good navigation and understand the environment better and prepare. So we'll be looking at things for the human adaptation, the topography and environment, the polar regions, because this is going to be a polar orbiter, not an equatorial one, and prepare for human space exploration. But ice is the big question that runs through the whole thing. So these are the, so in that rapid process we did to come up with the requirements and then complete the mission. These are the instruments that were selected for it to try to match those requirements. So we have one, and the naming's great, I think I love it. So we have one called CRATER that's from Boston University and MIT that's going to look at shielding constraints. So we didn't get a biological experiment on here yet because we weren't technically ready to send a biological experiment on a lunar orbiter yet. We had never gone that far with one. And that's one of the things we need to keep moving forward. And what that's going to look at is tissue equivalent responses to radiation. Diviner from UCLA looks at surface temperatures, so it's going to do scale maps of the temperature, which tells us information for planning for missions, but at the same time, it helps us to answer those ice questions about where ice could possibly be maintained. LAMP from Southwest Research Institute and looks at the maps of frost in the permanently shadowed area. LEND is a Russian instrument, and it looks for ice in the regolithic penetrate down to a meter, so it would give us maps of what the water ice is. It's very hard to get this answer about the water ice from any one instrument, but we're hoping by three or four different approaches to get something definitive. LOLA's from Goddard Space Flight Center, and it's a polar topography mapper that will help us with navigation. And then LROC is, again, another kind of mapping topography thing that looks in both the UV and the visible. So what I wanted to end with here, then, is some of the exploration biomedical issues, so you understand how this fits into that context, too. A top one is like a robust life support and habitation. Without that, we can't go. So that's very important to the human biomedical parts. Radiation protection, could give you a whole talk on that. Once we get beyond low Earth orbit, we're in an entirely new radiation environment, and it's rays that we don't normally work with here on Earth. They're not ones that are involved in either nuclear explosions or in biomedical uses of radiation, and so we need to understand more about that. We have a very active space radiation program to look at that, but also to understand how we can better shield. That's really one of the tall poles for being human exploration. Another thing for biomedical issues is the communications delays. And so that has both a psychological effect, but it's also for medical emergencies. How much do we have to have virtual doctors on board, or how many physicians do we have to have along? Or what, how can we prepare for not being in communication when medical emergencies happen? And part of that is also limited or no ability to return to Earth for contingencies. And so there you need a lot of autonomous clinical care. Another thing that's rising up is very important as we go up on these longer missions. It's like any other kind of mission where you have a small number of people going for a long time, and especially where they're going to be so disconnected, is psychosocial, behavioral, and performance issues. We want to have people working at their absolute optimum. We need improved therapeutics, things for wound care, non-invasive treatment capabilities, surgical supports, just the kinds of procedures. If you think about a Heimlich maneuver, think about doing a Heimlich maneuver in microgravity or low gravity. Grab the other person and you both shoot across the spaceship. So we need a different way to deal with that kind of thing. Increased diagnostic capabilities, because we're going to have to do that all remotely. And we're not right now. And medical consumables. How do you bring along IV-grade fluids? How do you generate that water? We can bring the powder, but we can't. How do we generate IV-grade water while we're out there? It's tough to take it with us. And what other kinds of dressings will stick on and reduce that? a lot of issues like that. And then finally, I don't know if you can see it for the table, but the big one I put in red at the bottom is dust mitigation, and that's what this workshop's all about. I want to leave that as a framework for you to think about how we have to deal with that. And I'll just end with what Admiral Steidel always likes to end with. This is a quote from Martin Luther King. We're not where we want to be yet, and we're not where we're going to be, but we're certainly not where we were yesterday. So thanks for coming.
Let's figure out how to move on.